You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the bureaucracy of terror. What does the apparent leak of Islamic State's personnel files tell us about the state of the 21st century jihad? My guests Samira Shackle and Alastair Bunkle will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including as more European countries pull up the drawbridge, German Chancellor Angela Merkel worries that Greece may be dangerously isolated. Aung San Suu Kyi's failure to find a constitutional loophole large enough to squeeze through into Burma's presidency, and Justin Trudeau in the United States. But why has it been so long since the White House rolled out the red carpet for a Canadian Prime Minister? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to today's programme. My guests today are the freelance journalist Samira Shackle and defence correspondent for Sky News, Alastair Bunkle, who joins us from their studios. Welcome both. We will start with this extraordinary story about Islamic State, who do appear to have learned a brisk lesson about data security in the online age. After thousands of IS personnel files were leaked to German and British media by a disillusioned jihadi who nicked a memory stick containing the names and contact details of 22,000 Islamic State foot soldiers. Alastair, first of all, the question that I think always has to be asked when a story or a scoop appears too good to be true, are there any doubts at all about whether this is genuine?
Not my end, no. And I mean, this is a story that has come from Sky News. These were documents given to a colleague of mine, our chief correspondent, Stuart Ramsey, and they have been checked out and their veracity has been looked into in great detail, and we are as sure as we possibly can be that these are genuine files. And I think that's probably corroborated by what we've been hearing from the intelligence services and the governments around Europe.
Just staying with you, Alastair, if the files are genuine and that appears to be the consensus, are there any concerns that they may be now, I guess, less valuable as an intelligence weapon that they've been made public? Presumably there is a furious amount of swallowing of SIM cards and changing names going on across Syria and Iraq right now.
Well, I mean, if we want to sort of discuss how, whether or not they're still valuable, I mean, I think their age will prove whether or not they retain any value. So if they are a year old or so, then things will have changed. Some of the fighters will have died. Some will have returned home to their native countries, for example. In terms of any locations that are on the documents, well, that is pretty easy for Islamic State to cover up. You just move within Iraq and Syria. But what is valuable and what will remain of great value to the intelligence agencies is some of the solid data and the personnel details about the people listed on those forms.
Samira, to bring it back to you here in the studio, it is a huge, huge data dump, an extraordinary trove of documents. Do you get a sense yet, I guess at least, there'll be more of this to come out, but have we learned anything about Islamic State that has surprised us here?
I think that there's always a sense of surprise at the sort of organisational element, the fact that to all intents and purposes, apart from the Islamic State logo in the top right-hand corner, that these could be questions on any sorts of job application forms, you know, things about your prior experience and so on, and your background, the route you've taken to travel there, all of those things, which I think, apart from giving an insight into the organisational structures of how IS is working, and there's been other sort of revelations. I think there was a document, I can't remember exactly when it was, about the sort of state structures and so on, funding and things like that, which again just shows that it's a very organised operation. It's not a sort of a load of, you know, gangsters in the desert with guns. It's people, you know, it's organised. But I think in addition to that, there's just the very basic use to governments overseas about prosecuting people. It's you know, if you've got all that information there in black and white, you don't really have to. It takes out a lot of the work of proving a case against someone.
But to come back to you, Alistair, on that point Samira raised, that, you know, and she's right, it does always seem somewhat jarring when behind this, any organisation that gets demonised, you know, and in this case not without reason in the press, as this sort of like ruthless terror organisation, this bedrock of bureaucracy is revealed behind it. There was a similar leak a few years ago of Al-Qaeda files full of people sending whining emails about not having their expenses reimbursed and so on and so on. Does it actually suggest that they are, though, you know, a actually serious organisation, that there is a level of organisational competence underpinning what they're doing?
Completely. I think it shows that there is a degree of bureaucracy within the organisation. I think as well, when you delve into the details, the general assumption is that people who go and fight for Islamic State are disillusioned. They are poor, they're down on their luck, they don't have much presenting them with any hope in society. And in the case of some people, that is the case. But there are plenty of others within these documents who were living pretty successful lives, actually. And that means that Western governments and societies have to question why it is that they have decided to go over to Syria and Iraq and join up. And just to pick up on a point that Samira is making about what it does show us about the network, it shows us the globalization of the network. Not that we never doubted that, but details of people from 51 different countries around the world, from the Middle East, from North Africa, from Europe, of course, but from America and from China as well. I mean, this really stretches around the globe.
Samira, Alistair that mentions that vast spectrum of nationalities from which IS are recruiting, but from these documents, we have learnt that 72% of their fighters, at least as of when these files were current, were Arabs, 25% of them Saudis. But other than Saudi Arabia, the main nationalities were Egyptian, Tunisian and Moroccan. What is there a reason for that North African connection beyond simple geography, that I suppose if you're determined to join Islamic State, it's easy to get there from Egypt than it might be from Malaysia or Indonesia?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think the proximity definitely plays a part. There's also the fact that these are all countries that have undergone lots of upheaval in recent years. Lots of them have had sort of issues over the course of decades with sort of varying shades of state repression, on depending where you're talking about. And I think that it, you know, if you add that to the sort of tinderbox of recent years in the region, and to the physical proximity, I think that that's quite a sort of potent thing. And as you say, it's not a surprise that the majority of fighters going there are from other Arab countries, other countries in the Middle East. But it's interesting to see it confirmed, because I think certainly in the West, when we're discussing IS, understandably there's a tendency to be slightly myopic about it, I think, and think only in terms of European fighters. But, you know, this is obviously still a Middle Eastern thing.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Alistair Bunkle. Coming up next, is Europe quietly cutting Greece loose? And is a democracy if the people's choice cannot be president?
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at Monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Monocle is partnering with France's first premium department store to create a seasonal shop at Le Bon Marché in the heart of Paris Rive Gauche, running until the 7th of May. An intelligent partnership between the global media brand and the fashion retailer, the shop will offer an array of Monocle products, from stationery to fashion, from travel to design. Alongside favorites from Porter and Alphonics, you'll find several products exclusively available at the shop, including collaborations with L'Uniforme, Maison Bourgeat, Arpin and Isaac Rena. come and visit the Monocle seasonal shop at Le Bon Marché on Rue de Sèvres in Paris until the 7th of May. We look forward to welcoming you.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Alistair Bunkle and Samira Shackle. We will continue with the latest efforts by several European states to pretend that either the ongoing migrant crisis isn't happening and or is someone else's problem. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has accused several countries within and without the EU of acting unilaterally to erect legal or actual barriers to the unceasing inflow. This is fair enough, as it is entirely accurate, but as Merkel also notes, it makes life increasingly and especially difficult for Greece, for which life was increasingly and especially difficult enough already. Samira, do you get the sense, as Merkel appears to, that Greece is being kind of eased out by everybody else to deal with this on its own? Because Greece does not have the luxury of barricading its entire borders. That the geographic reality is that is simply impossible. You can't fence off all the islands.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also, you know, if you think about Greece's position politically within the EU, and generally Greece is hugely weakened, I think, from all fronts. And there's a sense that they're just sort of being left to deal with it on their own by other states. And I think given what's going on in the EU, it's quite interesting that I think Merkel is coming from a position of really wanting a sort of joint way forward at a time when increasingly states are just really wanting to strike out on their own, which is what you see with this.
Well, the EU and Turkey cooked up some sort of deal earlier this week, the one-in, one-out deal, recasting the migrant crisis as a bad provincial nightclub. Do you think anyone thinks that will actually work?
Yeah, I'm not sure, really. And it's an interesting thing. I think that you know, that when Merkel's talking, she's sort of putting, and her criticism today of the closure of the Balkan route, she's putting a lot of weight on this possible deal with Turkey, which is firstly by no means certain at all. I mean, concessions will have to be made. It's still under discussion. And second of all, I'm not entirely sure how it'll work. It's sort of predicated on the idea that, first of all, that Turkey is the only way in, which it isn't. And second of all, that it's sort of viable, sending people back to Turkey and so on, and people are leaving Turkey in the first place because they're sort of gradually realising they don't have any sort of future in Turkey, and there's lots of Syrians who've been in Turkey for years now and are choosing to make the journey after several years because they're realising they don't have the right to work, they don't have a way of building a sustainable future. I don't know how that will quite be solved by shipping people from Greek islands to Turkey. Surely that it's just, I don't know, just sort of perpetuates the issue in perpetuity.
I mean, do you get the sense that a rightly or wrongly, a consensus is starting to build in Europe around a more robust approach? Austria's Interior Minister, Johanna Mikl-Leitner, said today that only, as she put it, a consistent signal will work as a deterrent. And this is the argument which has been made in different circumstances by Australia, that it may seem ruthless and unpleasant, but if you give people absolutely no incentive to come, they will stop coming, and that will save lives.
I'm not sure, actually. I think there's consistency that a robust approach is needed. I don't think there's any consistency on what that robust approach is. And so, you know, people that are quite agreed, I think, leaders across Europe, that they don't want so many migrants to be coming. But I think Merkel's right when she says that it's not actually sustainable. You know, you talk about, she said this in her speech, on the most basic level, you close the Balkan route into Europe, people will stop coming on that route. That will reduce the numbers in an immediate sense. What's not sustainable is tens of thousands of people being left in between borders, stranded there, and just sort of being expected to disappear. They're not going to disappear if they can't sort of go back or go forward. People are going to just find different routes, and that's what various human rights groups have been warning, that people will start coming by sea. You mentioned earlier that Greece can't actually secure its borders because of the sea route. I think now we're probably just going to see, if the Balkan route does remain closed, just see a spike in people coming again on immensely dangerous boat routes via Libya, coming to Italy again, which caused a huge number of deaths. I think that there is a consensus that we need to be strict on it and we need a policy, but there isn't really a consensus on how that should look and a practical way forward.
Alistair, I'll put the same question to you. Do you get the sense that this consensus is now developing around the idea that if Europe basically puts up legal or actual fences and makes it clear to people there is no way to European residency, then people will stop coming? I mean, I'm struck by the example of Malta, where I was a few months ago, and I spoke to the defence and security minister there, who said that there was a huge inflow of migrants to Malta at one point, but once they started to understand that once you arrived on Malta, you weren't getting off Malta, that there wasn't a way to the European mainland from Malta, they just stopped coming.
My sense, and I've reported from Malta and quite regularly from the channels through Greece as well, most recently a couple of weeks ago. My sense with Malta is it's a little bit of a one-off. It is much more isolated out in the Mediterranean than many of the other islands. The Greek islands are far easier to hop between and to get from somewhere like Lesbos, for example, to Athens or Thessaloniki. I don't think for a moment that if you close off that route or the Balkans route, that's the end of the matter. I think history, or the recent history, the last 18 months or so, has taught us that wherever you close off one channel, another channel will be found. And whether or not, as Samira says, that is into Italy, through Northern Africa, there is some talk even perhaps of Spain and the crossing into Spain being utilized, although that is much further west, of course. But yeah, I don't think that closing off the Balkan route will do the trick.
Then just to stick with you, Alistair, is there at least any sign that the EU or the EU leaders are beginning to realise that maybe they have to be a bit more rigorous, arguably even ruthless, about distinguishing between refugees from a country like Syria, which is not really somewhere anyone can live at the moment, and what might be described as economic migrants from, whether that's from Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, or even the Western Balkans, and making it clear that, you know, it's there is no way in here?
I think in their language there is, yeah. I think they are, you know, this deal that has recently been struck, yet to be implemented with Turkey, this one-in, one-out system. We will take in a genuine Syrian refugee and send back people who aren't genuine refugees, but are perhaps economic migrants. You know, that is great when it's said in the hallowed corridors of a EU building in Brussels. I think in reality it's anything but, to be quite honest. I don't see anything in the strategy. I don't see anything that is happening for real to really close this off. NATO have just started their mission in the Aegean Sea with six ships. I mean, there is at least 12 major islands in close proximity to the Turkish coast. So six ships will have an effect. Of course they will do. I mean, it's six is better than none. But it's not really going to tackle the problem. If you're going to do it properly, do it properly.
Samira, how much of this of the buck passing going on, which is not a new phenomenon, it's been going on now for the last 2 years, on this subject is driven by the fear that European leaders have of their own electorates? They realise there's not a huge amount of popular sympathy at large out there. And there is genuine concern in some European countries of the gains being made by really unpleasant far-right countries. Where is, I guess, if you're trying to make these decisions as a leader of a country, where is your primary obligation? Is it to the welfare of migrants, or is it to trying to maintain some sort of political balance at home?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and probably a bigger one than there's time to answer in a couple of minutes. But I think the whole sort of political philosophy around sort of where your obligations lie is a sort of huge and interesting subject. But I think on a sort of day-to-day level, of course, politicians in various European countries are concerned about their own electorates, and as they should be to an extent. But I think there's also, you know, I mean, even Merkel, I think, is facing, dissent at home in Germany. But I think in addition to that, you shouldn't be entirely bound by that, because otherwise then you would have always populist reactionary governments. And I think that while you do have an obligation to your own citizens, of course you do, I think that there's also a sense in which you could be making the case for certain things which need to be done, and not just need to be done on a humanitarian level, need to be done on a practical level. People aren't stopping coming, so why don't we design a sort of sensible, practical solution that will allow us to keep track of those people and to settle them humanely, even if it's temporarily, and to go, you know, sort of take them back to Syria when the war ends.
Okay, well, let's look now at Burma, where one of the world's longest delayed historical inevitabilities, the swearing-in of Aung San Suu Kyi as president, is set to be delayed a little longer. The National League for Democracy, the party she led to a thumping election win in November, has named its candidates for president, and she's not among them. She's sidelined by a constitutional clause, which just may have been drafted with her in mind, which prohibits the parents of foreign citizens from being head of state, and her sons hold British passports. Alistair, this is a weird start to get off to as, you know, a functional democracy, isn't it? Because she won't be president, but everybody's going to understand that she really kind of is, aren't they?
Yes. I think that she has made it pretty clear that she will govern from the sidelines. The man that is most likely to be president is a man called Tin Jaw, close aide to Aung San Suu Kyi, known of her all of his life. Very quietly spoken, educated in the UK, he's got a reputation for honesty and loyalty, and has been picked because he is close to her. And it would, I suppose, in an ideal world, be a close working relationship, but one where she has very great influence. I think in terms of democracy, it has to be viewed through the democracy or the recent history of Myanmar. And there have been great strides made in the last few years, and ultimately it will mean that the Burmese leader comes from the National League of for Democracy. Okay, it's not Aung San Suu Kyi, but isn't it a damn state a sight better state of affairs than it was when we had a military junta in charge?
I don't think anybody disputes that. It's certainly an improvement. But Samira, on that note, if we try and look at this from the general's perspective, it's fairly clear that Clause 59F was inserted into the Constitution basically specifically to stop Aung San Suu Kyi becoming president. But from their point of view, and they're trying, and credit where it's due, etc., to look like good guys. They're trying to look like the people who, you know, allowed their country to become a democracy again. From their own point of view, isn't this a bit counterproductive?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think it makes them look good. As you say, they've put quite a lot into, you know, looking like the good guys, as you put it. And I think that this doesn't particularly help because Aung San Suu Kyi, after winning such an overwhelming majority for the National League of Democracy in the elections, made a big point about reconciliation, national unity, and so on. And I think the fact that the military has appeared intransigent and flexible at the very first opportunity, I think, doesn't particularly make them look good in the eyes of the public or to the international community either. So I think that that's an interesting point. There's also, I mean, we don't know what the negotiations look like behind closed doors is the thing. I mean, it's possible that the military would have wanted certain political concessions, perhaps, in return for letting Aung San Suu Kyi be nominated for the presidency and lifting that clause. And perhaps they didn't want to make those kinds of concessions. So in the context of Myanmar as it is, as Alistair says, I think it's perhaps natural to expect baby steps forward.
A final thought from you on this subject, Alistair. It strikes me that there is a very interesting question of protocol here, because obviously there will be a long queue of world leaders wishing to make a visit to free democratic Burma or Myanmar. But basically the guy who's actually president's going to be sort of standing there with his hand outstretched at the end of the red carpet while everybody barges straight past him to go and get their picture taken with Aung San Suu Kyi, aren't they?
Yes, maybe. But you know, would it be such a bad thing if another person, as well as Aung San Suu Kyi, there was another man, Tin Jaw, who becomes world-renowned for making strides in democracy in Myanmar? I don't think so. Okay, it isn't a perfect scenario. Everybody wanted this ideal sort of ending to Aung San Suu Kyi's struggle, and a very painful struggle personally and otherwise that she's gone through, where she would then lead her country gloriously. But she will be very influential on Burma's future, as she already has been. Someone else will have to take the reins publicly. But I agree exactly with what Samira said. It is baby steps. And I just could never really imagine a situation where we went from sort of full-blown military junta to outright democracy, where the lady who used to be public enemy number one is now politician number one. And I just think it would take time to get there.
Okay, well, finally tonight, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has begun his official visit to Washington. Rather incredibly, it's the first such ceremonial by a Canadian leader in nearly two decades. Probably unsurprisingly, Trudeau and US President Barack Obama give every impression of getting on well. Much of the discussion at the pair's joint press conference was consumed by good-natured badinage about baseball and hockey. Samira, we looked into this, checked it and triple-checked it while we were researching it, because it just seems incredible. Does it seem weird that it's this long since a Canadian Prime Minister got the full-dress state dinner at the White House?
Yeah, I was really surprised when I read that as well in the news this morning. It seems very, very odd for countries which are neighbours, apart from anything else, and really close allies. So it's an odd thing. At first, I sort of wondered if it was just getting more attention because Justin Trudeau has the status of a celebrity in the way that Obama did when first elected. So it's very odd to think that that it's been such a long time.
And does it, I mean, Alistair, does it suggest to you that the United States takes Canada somewhat for granted?
Yeah, look, I've lived in London for many years and I've never done the tourist tour of Buckingham Palace. I think sometimes when things are on your own doorstep, you forget to do them. And I imagine because Canada is so close and essentially, you know, is an ally in trade terms, is an ally in military terms in NATO, that you often don't reach out the hand to your closest neighbour. If they're not necessarily the closest political allies, they are the closest geographically. There has been a fairly frosty relationship over the past few years between President Obama and Stephen Harper, the previous Canadian Prime Minister, for reasons that are largely centred around climate and the Keystone gas pipeline that President Obama opposed. That seems as though it's thawed somewhat, and I think President Obama's probably trying to make a point by making sure that Justin Trudeau has been invited for a state visit and invited very quickly.
Just to follow the thing up you were saying there as well, Samira, about you used the C word celebrity about Justin Trudeau, and you are absolutely right. He has been sort of, you know, applauded and lauded in a way that few elected leaders of anywhere are. What have you made of the beginnings of Trudeau mania in the United States? What is it people like about him? I mean, you know, he's a good looking chap. We can see that. Is it just that?
I don't think it's just that. I think it's also all the things that made Obama popular at the beginning, the sort of optimistic message at a time that's not always sort of allowing optimism to dominate. Optimistic message, hope and change and all of those things. And I think particularly in the US, where the political debate around the election is going so drastically in the opposite direction, Trudeau's sort of the ultimate anti-Trump, isn't he?
Alistair, I wanted to put to you something that Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Trudeau, also a Prime Minister of Canada, of course, said to his then-contemporary President Richard Nixon. He said that for Canada, living with you, by which he meant the US, is in some ways like sleeping with an elephant. No matter how friendly and even-tempered the beast, if I may call it that, one is affected by every twitch and grunt. Is that still an accurate characterization of US-Canadian relations, do you think?
It might be on an economic level. I don't think it is so on a wider foreign policy level. I mean, we've seen Justin Trudeau, upon coming into office, make some pretty swift decisions about Canada's involvement in the war against Islamic State, for example, withdrawing a lot of the Canadian presence in the Middle East, and has done so seemingly without any backlash from Washington. Otherwise, we probably would have heard about it on this particular state visit. I mean, Canada and the United States will always have to rub along pretty friendly together, and Canada will always be somewhat overshadowed by the bigger beast economically, financially, and on global level that is the United States. But I think what Justin Trudeau has to be a little bit careful of is being Canada's version of Barack Obama, because when too much hope is placed on your shoulders and you're the bright, shiny new kid on the block, we all know what could happen.
on that sobering note, we will leave it there. Alistair Bunkle and Samira Shackle, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all for today's show, which was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Monahan. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Up next, Carlotta Ribello is in with music on the Atlantic Shift. At 1900, you can hear The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. We'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll also be your host for that. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. Do tune in. Thanks for listening. I'm Andrew Muller. Good evening.